History through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, presented on the air and online by Provident Payments, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are stories there that should not go untold, and they really don't have to go untold if people like us are willing to take a little initiative and ask a few questions, and then invest the time to patiently listen as long-buried memories slowly resurface. Later in the show, I'm going to introduce you to someone who has done exactly that. But you know, this show is all about our veterans, and we want to, first of all, honor our veterans for their service and their sacrifice. We want to do our best to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And of course, in that process, not only are we educated, not only are we entertained, and I know you will be today, but so often we really are inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. Today's episode takes us to Kittitas County, Washington, home to about 2,300 square miles and Central Washington University, but fewer than 50,000 people in the entire county. We're going to meet one very special World War II veteran who lives there, and also a friend of hers whose efforts are responsible for preserving the military memories of 58 World War II vets there. That included every known World War II veteran in the county when that project began nearly a decade ago. If you ever get the chance to visit Kittitas County, you'll appreciate the sweeping vistas of the mighty Columbia River on its eastern edge and the majestic views of Snoqualmie Pass to the west. And before we hear today from one of World War II's woman Marines who still lives in Ellensburg, I want you to hear why you need to pull off of Interstate 90 in Clay Elum, a city of a little more than 2,000 there in the heart of the Cascades. And you know, we've met plenty of Coast Guardsmen on this program over the years, but did you know that in the 231-year history of that branch of service, there has only been one recipient of the Medal of Honor who earned our country's most prestigious military award while serving in the U.S. Coast Guard? Only one, Signalman First Class Douglas A. Monroe. Clay Elum, Washington is where he grew up, and Clay Elum, Washington is where you'll find his grave, surrounded by a moving memorial that includes two massive guns borrowed from ships. I have some photos of this memorial posted for you at hometownheroesradio.com and on the Hometown Heroes Facebook page, and I have a feeling that reading you the Medal of Honor citation will make it very clear why so many people stop in Clay Elum to visit that memorial. For extraordinary heroism and conspicuous gallantry in action above and beyond the call of duty as petty officer in charge of a group of 24 Higgins boats engaged in the evacuation of a battalion of Marines trapped by enemy Japanese forces at Point Cruz, Guadalcanal, on 27 September 1942. After making preliminary plans for the evacuation of nearly 500 beleaguered Marines, Monroe, under constant strafing by enemy machine guns on the island, and at great risk of his life, daringly led five of his small craft toward the shore. As he closed the beach, he signaled the others to land, and then, in order to draw the enemy's fire and protect the heavily loaded boats, he valiantly placed his craft, with its two small guns, as a shield between the beachhead and the Japanese. When the perilous task of evacuation was nearly completed, Monroe was instantly killed by enemy fire, but his crew, two of whom were wounded, carried on until the last boat had loaded and cleared the beach. By his outstanding leadership, expert planning, and dauntless devotion to duty, he and his courageous comrades undoubtedly saved the lives of many who otherwise would have perished. He gallantly gave his life for his country. Again, that was the Medal of Honor citation for Douglas Monroe, the only Coast Guardsman to ever be awarded the Medal of Honor. There's a much longer story posted on the National World War II Museum's website, and I have that story linked for you at hometownheroesradio.com. But here's one more fascinating little tidbit for you. In May 1943, President Franklin D. Roosevelt presented the Medal of Honor to Monroe's parents, James and Edith. And what did Edith Monroe do a few hours later? She enlisted in the Coast Guard at age 48. She went through boot camp and earned a commission in the Spars. Edith ran the Coast Guard barracks in Seattle until the end of World War II. So Edith Monroe was one of the more than 300,000 American women in uniform during the war, a small but crucial portion of the more than 16 million Americans total who served during those war years. And you can imagine that 76 years later, there aren't too many of them left, but we have the privilege of meeting one today. 97-year-old Barb Schober lives in Ellensburg, Washington, county seat of Kittitas County. During World War II, she was one of a little more than 20,000 American women who blazed a special trail in the Marine Corps Women's Reserve. We're going to hear about that, but let's start, as we always do, with childhood. And Barb, what do you remember about growing up here in Central Washington in the 20s and 30s?
Well, I grew up down in Sunnyside and Grandview, and then I eventually, as soon as I got out of school, when I was 16, I went to a business school in Seattle, and from there I worked for Precision Roebuck, and when I was a little older, I went to California and stayed with my sister and brother-in-law. I went to work then at Inglewood for North American Aviation.
Well, and I want to hear about that, but I'm curious, too, about even before that. And you mentioned your sister. How many kids were there in your family? How many siblings?
Three. There was my older sister and then a younger sister that was almost 10 years younger than I. So she was a baby of the family.
Well, I have a couple daughters at home, and I'm just thinking their childhood has probably been a little different than what it was for you three girls. Do you remember those Depression years and what it was like?
Absolutely. I'm a Depression baby. And I remember that very well. My mother and I used to go out and anything we could do, pick cherries and grapes, anything, potatoes, apples, whatever we could do, it helped to make us that much better. And my dad worked too. I don't know, we just worked really hard.
How old were you, do you think, when you were out there picking fruit to make money for the family?
About 9 or 10 years old. I wasn't very old. And my mother didn't take time to hardly ever eat. She just worked hard all of her life. And I picked asparagus and anything that we could do. So that was our life.
And the world's a lot different now, especially for women. When you were a girl growing up, was there something in your mind of, hey, when I grow up, this is what I might want to do or what I might want to achieve?
I wanted to be really a good person, and I wanted to have lots of boyfriends. And I had a lot of things that I liked to do, and I liked all the big bands and the dancing, and I learned to danced from all over the country. Whatever they danced, I danced, because that was the way.
What do you think was your favorite big band of that era?
I liked Count Basie a lot. And we used to go right from one place to the next, because that's the way that it was down there in Los Angeles. You just go out of one nightclub where they were dancing and go into another.
And how old did you say you were when you moved out there?
By that time, I was 17.
We're recording this on your 97th birthday, so this is 80 years ago. So this is 1941, and this is before the attack on Pearl Harbor. And Los Angeles has changed a little bit, too, in those 80 years. What did you enjoy about that area then?
Well, you drove forever from one place to another, and now it's just all one big community. I met Charlie Ruggles, who was a movie star. I saw Judy Garland, Lana Turner, and a whole bunch of us. We went to a bowling alley one time, and I met Henry Fonda, and Don Wayne was there. So it was easy to run into the people, because they liked to go out too. So I wasn't the only one that went out.
And they didn't have the paparazzi following them around yet.
Right, they didn't. Absolutely. They just would go in just like themselves, and people left them alone.
And you said, so you started working in the North American Aviation Factory.
And then when I got finished with that, I came up and I worked for McCormick Ship Lines, and we sent Lend-Lease to Russia.
And at North American, what were you doing down there?
I worked for the last office before they put the plant out, and we went through and wrote down anything that we had that the Army needed, and they were B-25s. And later on, they did the P-51s. And my brother-in-law was a man that taught them. He was able to take, found he could put a 50 caliber machine gun on a P-51, and he figured out how to do that. He was really, he could do anything. And they shot down, that's the reason they won so soon in Africa, because the plane, the B-51s, used to come down with that 50 caliber machine gun, and just, that was the end of the tanks.
So you're still a teenager, but you're helping assemble these aircraft.
Yeah, absolutely. They were all done. It was all done. And it was just the B-25s that went past us.
So you were just inspecting that all the rivets were in and everything was...
No. We were making sure that everything that the Army needed was in there. And we had a list of things that we'd put down and we would go all through. And so a B-25, you had to crawl up a tiny space, up the all metal, up to where the co-pilot and the pilot and the navigator sat.
So you would have to sit in the cockpit and take inventory of all the instruments and make sure they're all there?
Yeah. And anything else, the bomb sites and the whole thing.
And so am I inferring correctly that Southern California is where you were on December 7th, 1941?
No. I remember I was on my way to my aunt and uncle's in Seattle, and the Japanese attacked Pearl Harbor. And so I got on the bus, and all we did was that whole time was sit around and listen to the radio about what was going on. So it was really interesting. I remember there was gasoline rationing, and I stayed until it was too late to catch the bus. And my uncle took me down to catch another bus so I could find my way home.
Are you saying that you were so wrapped up in the radio reports about Pearl Harbor you didn't want to leave and you missed your bus?
Yeah, exactly. Time just flew by. So we were all of us were sitting listening to the radio.
And did you see things change pretty rapidly after that?
Oh, yeah. Blackout curtains completely. And everybody, my uncle was on the watch, that you had a watch for each place. He would go out at night, and if somebody left a curtain open, he would knock on the door and tell them so that they would put a blackout curtain on.
I know you lived through this, so it's maybe not as eye-opening as for someone who didn't, but some people don't even know that this happened. But it happened up and down the West Coast because the fear was the Japanese were going to come attack these cities. So in Seattle, you're saying, you had to black out your curtains at night so there's no light.
Absolutely. And when I was in California, I talked to this fellow, and he said he was sworn to secrecy. But what they shot down was unbelievable. So I don't know what it was, but there was something. I've always remembered that, because he said they shot something down with their guns.
So that something presumably Japanese that they shot down in Southern California?
Never knew, because he wasn't supposed to tell. And remember, during that time, they used to say, loose lips, shank, ships. So whatever you did, you didn't talk about it. Nobody did. What they did in the daytime, as far as war effort was concerned, they didn't talk about it at all. And of course, people were making a lot more money then, finally. The Depression and then the wartime. And then I worked for Montgomery Ship Line in Seattle. And from there is when I went into the Marines.
So that's what I want to know. What made you want to do that? What was the sales pitch that got you to say, hey, I'm going to be one of the very few, the very proud female Marines?
A girl that was older than me, and she was the secretary to the Boeing, Bill Boeing, the president of Boeing Company, and she joined the Marines. And then one of the girls joined the Army. Another one joined the Coast Guard. And one girl with me, Hal Nargang, and I joined up at the same time into the Women Marines. And she was stationed at Quantico. We all wanted to do something for our war effort. So we did, and it was wonderful.
It's time for our first break, but don't you want to hear why 97-year-old Barb Schober felt her time in the Marine Corps Women's Reserve during World War II was so wonderful? I know I do. She spent much of her service time in the other Washington, D.C., and we'll hear about that, plus a more recent trip to our nation's capital with Inland Northwest Honor Flight. Before we're done, you're also going to meet the woman who introduced us to Barb and who has honored every known World War II vet in Kittitas County in a very powerful and meaningful way. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this. Do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for far too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I've got to tell you, when it comes to your money, I believe I found a better way with EECU. Take a look at my EECU.org and you'll see why. EECU is not a bank. It's a nonprofit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. Close to 300,000 members now in 10 different California counties. Over 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And what I really love is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. In 2013, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. More than 1,000 veterans now have gotten to see their memorials in Washington, D.C. for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement EECU takes oh so seriously. Pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 800-538-3328.